That's the national anthem of the People's Republic of China. Red China, Chi-Com China, introducing us here to another episode of Conservative Casual Friday, where we like to talk about issues of the day, current events for conservatives and others. And today we want to talk about China policy and Joe Biden, whether he's Beijing's man in Washington. And joining us, we have conservative commentator Benjamin Weingarten, among other things. He's a fellow at the Claremont Institute and has been recently writing a lot on China. He's working on a forthcoming book on China. Well, Ben Weingarten, welcome to the show.
Andrew, thanks so much for having me. It's a real pleasure. It's been too long.
Yeah, we had you on before to talk about Ilhan Omar earlier before on the show back then called Focusing on Islam and Focus. And today we're looking at China. Well, starting out, thinking of China policy in the United States, we can go back to the days when China got its most favored nation status, I can remember, under Bill Clinton in 1998 or so, if I'm recalling the year correctly, and looking through the Bush years and so forth. What have been the arguments in the past for having such market openings, engagement with China, and have those arguments succeeded? Have they proven true?
The foreign policy establishment view of China for decades began, I think, with the best of intentions and somewhat less naively under the Nixon administration, where the idea was, look, we're in the Cold War, we're engaged with the Soviet Union as the greatest adversary that we face. Let's try to split off the Chinese Communist Party from the Communist Party of the Soviet Union. That makes sense in terms of trying to divide and conquer, create a wedge when you're in a Cold War context. But even from the earliest, even from the beginnings of this relationship, there was also a clear view that China, given its size, resources, the potential of its people, that it created a potentially lucrative marketplace for America, a potential boon to American industry, to financial services companies, and well beyond. Now, the more sort of sanguine argument that was made was, and oh, by the way, this economic liberalization, purported economic liberalization, really trade with China, opening up of commercial relations, would ultimately lead China to become more like America. That is, if you engage in trade and you become prosperous and you develop the purported Pacific relations that will come as an outgrowth of trade, because you'll be rewarded for these dealings and there will be sort of a cultural thawing, that ultimately it would lead China to be a more amenable power and one with which the U.S. can do business, which can foster strong relations and which can ultimately create stability in the Indo-Pacific. And that entire rationale, which I think in some ways was cast to paper over the fact that really this was about dollars and cents at the end of the day, and those in our what I would call the ruling class didn't really care so much about seeing the CCP ultimately evolve to the extent it can. And I would argue it cannot really evolve if it adheres to its Marxist-Leninist Maoist principles. Ultimately, it has proven a failure because America has in reality become more like communist China than China has become like America. And you see that with the anti-cultural revolution that's going on in the streets of America today. You see it with the China envy of much of our ruling class and the way they've, which in many ways been co-opted and corrupted due to the influence of these Chinese relations, and looking at China with awe in terms of its technocracy, its ability to achieve purported breakneck growth and purported stability, so-called, euphemistically, in their society as well. So at the end of the day, the entire rationale about economic liberalization leading to political liberalization has proven false. And the biggest exemplar of that is the fact that Xi Jinping has amassed more power and more control in himself, in his office, of any leader in China since Mao. So we've gone from Maoism to Deng Xiaoping, biding your time as you build up your strength, to today, a China that is fully ascendant, brazen in its ambitions, aggressive, And of course, the best example of this is the way it's exploited the Chinese coronavirus to try to advance its ambitions globally.
Well, thinking of such economic integration or liberalization, has the United States benefited from this China relationship? I mean, people talk about like, look at all these goods we're buying in Walmart, or what about agricultural markets? You know, someone like me originally coming from the Midwest, Minnesota, I mean, that's a big deal out there in Iowa and Minnesota having this massive agricultural market in China. How about that side of the equation?
Yeah, so I think, you know, at the most extreme, what we can say is that part of the way that administrations like the Clinton administration sold the opening of economic relations with China was that they said this would be good for American labor. It would create jobs. There are studies out there proving that thousands of jobs were ultimately outsourced and destroyed in the manufacturing and industrial industries in particular as a consequence of that opening. And then at its most extreme, you can see that there are areas of the country, particularly in the Rust Belt, that have been hollowed out, at least in part as a consequence of the opening of the China trade and outsourcing of labor to a place where it was cheaper and there are no standards in place like we have in America. So sort of referred to as sweatshop labor. In some cases, it truly is. And then, to add insult to injury, you have China, which is maybe the world's greatest distributor of fentanyl illegally across the world, which further has devastated many communities across the country. So I would say that's one of the worst example, the most egregious example of the downsides to the trade. But I'd say even more generally than that, yes, the sort of best spin you can put on it is cheaper goods for Americans and the freeing up of Americans from jobs that were not their highest and best use. That's the rosiest spin you can put on it. But the other side of this equation is that we now find ourselves in a situation where pretty much every strategically significant supply chain that we care about, from medicine, as has been shown in the coronavirus, to weaponry and other parts of heavy industry, to technology, of course, strategic communications and the infrastructure over which all information flows, is now almost every single aspect strategically significant in our country that you can think of. Those supply chains run through China in whole or in part. At minimum, they have parts in them created by communist China. And in some cases, we have seen that China has corrupted those parts and used them potentially to pilfer information or to potentially be able to sabotage critical machinery. So one of the downsides has been that as a consequence of the opening of this relationship, China has benefited in the way of pilfering our intellectual property, predatory practices, forced technology transfer, joint ventures that are completely one-sided. They've received all of the benefits of the gaining entree to the world financial and trade architecture to which America gave them entree, and also the benefits of dealings with American businesses. And they have not acted as a good partner in consequence to it. And on the contrary, we've put ourselves in a position where in so many vital areas, we are reliant on communist China in whole or in part. And I go back to the coronavirus, where one of the Chinese Communist Party mouthpiece publications threatened to plunge America into a sea of coronavirus. That is, by not allowing us medicine, critical medicine. And then, of course, there's also the PPE itself, personal protective equipment, which it appears that the Chinese Communist Party directed be hoarded while the rest of the world suffered. So that's just the clearest example of the fact that China has used this trade to become a dominant world power in the economic realm. And while Americans have received cheap goods for it, it's been at the consequence of our long-term strategic interest. And that goes to the point, and it's a point that runs through a lot of my writing and thinking, which is that we've essentially sold out our national interest for effectively bread and circuses. And American industry and our large multinational corporations have not put America first in their dealings with communist China. And it's been to the detriment of the American people ultimately and our long-term viability, because China seeks to be the dominant world power and uses commerce as a wedge, as a tool that it can exploit and ultimately leverage to co-opt others, dominate, expand its spheres of influence, so that ultimately China can be the dominant world power and control how we act without ever firing a shot.
Yeah, that raises interesting raises a lot of interesting points there. I mean, one thing talk about one interesting issue. You said that China illegally is one of the largest producers of fentanyl in the world, which then has as I guess a key part of the opioid crisis in the United States. How does that work? Why has China become that?
I think it begs the question, and you know, you can look at the nefarious aspect of it. Of look, is this something that they can use to sort of kick a competitor in the U.S. while it's down to flood our shores with drugs that end up hollowing out communities and ruining the lives of those who consume them after those communities were already decimated in part as a consequence of the outsourcing of the jobs to China? I mean, I think you just look at the facts and it speaks for themselves. What could their possible positive motivation be? And also look at the Chinese Communist Party's policies. Now, the Trump administration pushed to have the CCP, the Chinese government, crack down on the production and distribution of fentanyl, but the proof has to be in the pudding, and it's yet to be seen, even though I do believe there were a few crackdowns that were reported out there. It's yet to be seen what ultimately has been done to the total volume of the flooding of our shores with these drugs. And I would say, if you just look at the facts, I think this speaks to just one of the myriad malign ways in which they've tried to take advantage of us. And this is a particularly nefarious one. Another one that I've spoken to in a couple pieces is the attempt to exploit the coronavirus by using Chinese companies to provide the testing tools, as well as potentially even build the labs for collecting samples with respect to the coronavirus in this country, which and the company behind it is China's leading genomics company. And you can imagine the myriad ways in which an adversary could exploit having access to our literal, I mean, most personal sensitive data that's associated with the DNA of American citizens. That these are just two small areas in which China has sought to exploit our relationship. But we can think of any other number of nefarious acts they've taken as well.
Yeah, it strikes me, thinking of the fentanyl, it strikes me as sort of maybe a parallel, you know, that the Taliban allows for the growing of opium poppies. You know, they don't really care about, you know, drugs coming in the United States, heroin or whatever, even though, of course, in Afghanistan, they themselves would be very anti-drug. Or maybe if you want to use a historical example with China, it maybe would strike some people as kind of an opium war in reverse. You know, you had the trade, the British, you know, they got Hong Kong in 1842, the island in the second opium war, I think it was, when they wanted to prevent the Chinese from stopping the flow of opium from India into China. That was a sort of key British trade. So maybe the Chinese are playing that back on us.
I think it's a great point. And of course, these historical narratives have a lot of credence on the mainland. One of the things that Xi Jinping has done is try to instill in the people a sense of the fact that the West exploited China, took advantage of it, humiliated it. China was the middle kingdom. It was the dominant world power, thriving and innovative, and the West came in and ruined it for them, essentially, and subjected them to all manner of humiliation and did not accord China the due deference that it deserved and the respect that it deserved. And consequently, today, China is rising back to its rightful place as the dominant world power. And so that's just a long digression of saying those historical narratives are important. And I think your analysis there is quite right and prescient and insightful, that this is something of an opium war in reverse, and likely the leadership would see it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I remember in graduate school at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy, you know, fellow Chinese students we had there, of course, many of whom, or perhaps all of whom, were members of the Communist Party, although they apparently had some doctrine or teaching that they weren't really supposed to reveal it. I would ask them, are you a member of the Communist Party? And they didn't really want to admit it. One finally admitted it. But, you know, one conversation I had at a party, we got to talking to various students about I and others, you know, a typical sort of Fletcher School party. You get to talking about world events all over at a party, we started talking about Taiwan, and this one guy from China said, "Look, you know, Chinese nationalism is very strong, and we beat you in Vietnam by supporting the Vietnamese against you Americans, and we're ready to fight for Taiwan." And so it's very strong there, very strong sentiments. And I guess I'm trying to think, it was whether it was Mao himself or his foreign minister Chu Enlai who had the famous statement, "China has stood up." With the founding of the People's Republic of China, the sense of, we've thrown off Japanese aggression, Western domination, and so forth, and the period of chaos and disorder, and now we're unifying together as China. Well, looking at our own leadership, thinking of these presidents, what is the relationship of now our current president, Joe Biden, and of course, there have been issues with his son, Hunter, with China?
Yeah, it's a critical point, and I've written at length. I wrote in the run-up to the election because I just thought it's such a glaring issue, the contrast in the Trump administration's policy towards China versus the likely Biden administration policy towards China, which I view as our greatest adversary by far globally, the greatest threat that we face externally. And Joe Biden is the archetype, the sort of living, breathing personification of the establishment view of communist China, which for decades had been, let's integrate with China, engage China, help it grow strong. A rising and powerful China as a world power is a good thing for the world and for America. And Joe Biden himself has said that almost verbatim. He said that when he was vice president in charge of the China portfolio during the Biden administration. But even going beyond that, from almost the opening itself, Joe Biden assumed office as senator, I believe, in around 1979, and he traveled to China after relations were normalized then, so shortly thereafter. He has sung the praises of communist China for decades. He supported, as you noted, the sort of normalization of trade with China, delinking it from human rights, gaining entree to the World Trade Organization and beyond. So all of the sort of engagement-focused policies that have underpinned this growing relationship, which I believe is sort of a relationship of mutually assured destruction where we've become inextricably intertwined with China, and now we have to figure out how we're going to grapple with that fact. Joe Biden has been there. I mean, this was the chair of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee during the time that relations between America and China grew inextricably intertwined. His essential only kind of criticism, really, if you look back in the records, was on nuclear proliferation. He at times spoke out somewhat strongly against China on it, but speaking out is one thing, and actually supporting legislation or supporting executive action when he was a vice president and now president is entirely another thing. And talk is cheap, particularly when it comes to China, because all manner of presidents have talked tough about China on the campaign trail from Clinton to George W. Bush and beyond, and then governed differently. But Joe Biden, remember, even up to 2019, and I think even 2020, was out there saying China's a real competitor to us. Come on, man. He sort of shrugged it off. And then over time, he started to say, well, China's a competitor. And then he says, well, China's our greatest competitor, but Russia is still sort of the number one adversary. So he wouldn't go so far as to call China an adversary in rhetoric during the campaign when he was trying to show that he could out-tough Donald Trump on the issue. In terms of policy itself, let's remember that the Obama-Biden administration essentially did nothing with respect to communist China. They entered into what they thought was an agreement, a sort of no cyber warfare agreement that China broke with impunity. They did nothing to defend, in reality, the South China Sea and China's infringement upon the sovereignty of other nations there. Although, they did run some freedom of navigation operations. It was nothing really more than that. China built its man-made islands, expanding what it considers its territory, again, basically with impunity. And then Biden himself was involved, it appears, according to reporting, in the negotiations with China that would essentially allow China access to U.S. capital markets, even though it didn't provide the kind of rigorous reporting standards to which companies working under any other nation have to provide in order to get access to U.S. capital markets. So he essentially helped provide a waiver in the way of a memorandum of understanding that granted China continued access to our capital markets. And of course, there have been any number of massive frauds that have resulted as a consequence of Chinese entities having access to our markets and not providing the basic reporting that every other company under the sun must provide. So that's a long-winded way of saying that Joe Biden has been an advocate of the integration, accommodation, appeasement agenda for essentially his entire career. And that's before, of course, we get to his family's dealings with Chinese Communist Party-linked entities and individuals, his son Hunter in a sort of private equity context. But even beyond that as well, there was a joint investigation put out, I believe, by one of the oversight committees within the Senate. It was a joint operation, and I believe it was Senators Grassley and Johnson who headed it up. And in their report, they talk about all manner of shady transactions between Biden family members and not just Hunter Biden and Chinese Communist Party linked individuals and entities. And then, of course, we have the reporting, the laptop emails and the like, which seem to indicate that potentially Joe Biden himself was involved with some of the conversations around doing business with such individuals and entities, and that even some of the profits or some of the ownership in these projects might be kicked up to, quote unquote, the big guy, Joe Biden. Even if you didn't have any of his family's dealings that are compromising and represent a conflict of interest and a threat to national security in and of themselves, if it was just Joe Biden's record itself, that's damning enough and should have caused every American to be skeptical and heavily scrutinize him as a candidate, given that China is, I believe, the greatest adversary that we face. But then you add in the family dealings with communist China, and it only adds to the potential danger for America. And we can go into this. I've written at length about already the administration's earliest actions with respect to communist China, which are completely in line with what you would expect based on this background, as well as the personnel who will be executing them, who themselves have largely for their careers supported the same policies and also have had direct or two-step remove interactions with Chinese Communist Party-linked individuals and entities, which is just a disaster for the country.
Yeah, you've written in some of your pieces I've looked at the Federalist, you've written about, like, for example, Secretary of State Anthony Blinken had roles at the University of Pennsylvania with the Penn Biden Institute there that had Chinese funding that, you know, and other individuals who have given, you know, speeches before, like branches of this Confucius Institute that's a Chinese government-run sort of influence operation, cultural institutes around the United States at universities. What about Kamala Harris? Does she have any China background?
So, you know, I haven't really been able to dig in on Harris as much as I might have liked, but I will say generally she has had those in her orbit with very radical views, to say the least, I guess, as is the case with anyone who's a senior politician in California, and in particular in the San Francisco area. And it bears noting that the San Francisco area has been a hotbed of CCP activity from its embassy, it's been reported. And then also sort of these ancillary groups acting as sort of cultural ambassadors or cultural exchange and the like, who it seems are at a minimum captive to the CCP's narratives, and at times also work in even more nefarious means. So, you know, to be a little more specific, I've written at length about Dianne Feinstein, senator from herself from San Francisco as well, and her interactions with these sorts of groups. Eric Swalwell himself, who sits on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence, as I'm sure listeners know, had interactions with, it appears, an agent of communist China. And that was through, I believe, a student organization originally that this sort of spy, in effect, or influence agent at a minimum, had gained entree to politicians in the area. So it's all a way of saying I don't have any direct evidence of Harris's links to CCP-linked individuals or entities, you know, beyond the sort of traditional diplomatic entreaties that exist when you're a politician in the San Francisco area and there's a very large Chinese population, and then China itself does have its own entities and organs explicitly like its embassy there. And I do believe that she's attended events there and spoken with individuals associated with it. Anything beyond that would be speculation at this point, but it stands to reason that given how penetrated San Francisco is by the CCP and then favorable groups, that if one were to start digging in, it would be to my great surprise if she had not had interactions with any of those individuals that could be troubling. And that's before one would look into, for example, if you were really going to do this in the sort of forensic and deep way that one should, going through donors, events that she's attended, and looking beyond those relationships as well, projects that, you know, she may have overseen while in office, which might have had a China angle to them. It'd be hard to imagine that she would not have had interactions with certainly questionable individuals, given how senior she was and coming from the San Francisco area.
Yeah, that's interesting. Yeah, San Francisco being a hotbed of, I guess that's only logical that China, of course, would have given the prominent Asian and Chinese community on the West Coast and in San Francisco that would be an important Chinese consulate in the San Francisco area. And of course, all the business dealings from the West Coast on Silicon Valley as well, in particular with China and all the universities, University of California and Stanford University, UCLA, those would all be significant targets of interest. Well, thinking of the Chinese economy, you know, you mentioned Chinese businesses and their linkages to the Chinese government. Can any business with China be described as free enterprise? I mean, what's the relationship between the CCP, the Chinese government, and any company in China when you talk about like stock market listings or anything else?
Yeah, essentially, it's codified that whatever economic interests companies have, every single entity that operates at the pleasure of the Chinese Communist Party, which is every Chinese company, de facto or de jure, in the sense of literally having CCP party members embedded in cells within the companies and increasingly even making business decisions within the companies. And this is putatively private companies before you get to state-owned or state-backed companies as well, where it's a very explicit tie. The fact of the matter is that national security and really probably more broadly the national interest, but really the party's interest in communist China is number one. In other words, all businesses are essentially subordinated to the CCP, its objectives, its ambitions, and its rigors and sort of the strictures that it puts on companies. And in one way that you see this is in the fact that their national security and intelligence laws essentially say that businesses should turn over anything and everything or are required to work with the government in pursuit of its security interests. So, you know, what the CCP defines as its security interests could be essentially anything. I mean, it's limitless to consider what that could potentially implicate. So, again, even setting aside the fact that increasingly, the Communist Party itself is mandating that cells be embedded within companies and increasingly not just for ideological purposes, but actually to make business decisions as well. Much more broadly than that, companies essentially exist for the benefit of the state. They don't exist as independent entities in and of themselves. And that presents a real problem for us, obviously, given that you have to assume then that any company in a strategically significant sector that Americans do business with is working at the behest of an adversarial regime. And beyond that, there's also the benefits for those companies and to our detriment of the ability for the Chinese Communist Party to put its full weight behind entities to act on non-economic bases to ultimately dominate in particular industries and put out of business Western businesses so that then a Chinese company can dominate a particular sector. So the sort of textbook quintessential example of this is Huawei. And we don't need to go through the whole rise of Huawei, but to the extent your audience isn't familiar with it, there are indicators that Huawei was started with the backing of the Chinese Communist Party, and the founder of the company himself was a member of the CCP in fairly high standing himself. And the way Huawei sort of rose to power, one of the ways in which it did so, beyond substantial state backing and some pivotal state contracts as well, is it essentially underbid all of its competitors when it came to building telecommunications infrastructure around the world. And it was able to underbid and act on completely non-economic terms because of the backing of the party itself. So as a consequence of that, you had other telecommunications companies hollowed out and ultimately put out of business in the West, and Huawei there to pick up all the market share. Beyond that, of course, Huawei has gone out and bought essentially the best talent from around the world. So while it is a so-called Chinese company, it's also bought the intellectual capital from around the world. So it's essentially used capitalism against us to some extent, but you can't, I don't know that you can really call it capitalism so much as entities operating with the backing of a government in order to pursue the government's objectives. I mean, it's not really free market per se. Yes, these are business entities. They do produce a good or service that people want to buy at a particular price. But the way in which they have achieved their dominant positions has been with full state backing. And that's been one of the downsides, returning to one of your earlier questions, about the opening of trade with China. They've gained all of the benefits of capitalism, but they haven't adhered to the same standards that we do, because ultimately they've used capitalism as a tool to promote communism.
Yeah, that brings up interesting parallels. It occurs to me, thinking years back, right after September 11th in the years, I guess it was in 2002 or 2003, there came the controversy, I don't know if you recall this, of from the United Arab Emirates. There was a proposal that a company there, Dubai Ports, they wanted to enter into a contract to manage port facilities in the United States. And there's all this uproar, and ultimately the deal was scuttled. But, you know, as you've written, foreign investment in the United States is subject to the review by this Committee on Foreign Investment in the United States, CFIUS, you know, but it seems in contrast to this small Arab sheikdom Gulf state, UAE, here we just have issues all over the place with this massive country of China with over some, 1.3 billion people, one of the largest economies in the world. Just about any investment, any business would raise all sorts of problems under such a CFIUS review. Do we need like a new Comic-Con regime to, for example, stop any technology transfer to China as we had with the Soviet bloc during the Cold War?
Yeah, and the Trump administration did seek to, with the legislative branch as well, seek to strengthen CFIUS, and there was some new legislation put forth, and the administration did undertake, I believe, a fairly substantial increase in reviews of transactions and did halt certain transactions as well. But I think we have to be thinking this way, because if you work under the assumption that any company in any strategically significant sector might actually not be a company, but is an organ or just another arm of the CCP, then of course, in any strategically significant area, you have to be skeptical of doing any business with them. And of course, even beyond the strategically significant areas, money is fungible. So if you're doing business that is ultimately propping up a malign adversarial regime and filling its coffers and therefore allowing it to expand its spheres of influence in all manner of ways, you ought to think really seriously about, at a very high level, what kind of relationship economically do we want to have with such a power? So, I'm sort of leaning towards the extreme end of there needs to be a complete decoupling, or at least a full review and assessment of where could you possibly do business that it would actually be within America's self-interest to continue transacting with China, again, assuming that it's the Chinese Communist Party. And the other point that I'll make is, even if the trade was completely above board, mutually beneficial, we're not talking about industries like in telecommunications or, God forbid, in weaponry or microchips or other area or medicine and genomics, and you can think of all the other dangerous areas. Even if we're talking about bread and butter business, truly above board, you can't find any link to the CCP that would really raise red flags for you. The sheer economic intercourse alone presents problems for us, and that is because – I would suggest that part of China's foreign influence efforts almost definitionally is interaction with the West through trade. If you're an executive at a company and you're dealing with your counterpart in a Chinese company, stands to reason that the CEO or the president or managing director or whatever level on the other side is likely in that position in part with the blessing of the CCP, at least implicitly. And in many cases, of course, the founders of these companies are members of the Chinese Communist Party. Consequently, those interactions have to have an impact on the American counterparts doing those dealings. And that's going to lead them to probably take a softer view of the CCP, to essentially maybe speak in the narratives of the Chinese Communist Party, to, of course, oppose policies that might lead to restrictions on trade with the CCP. So the influence alone of even completely above board transactions is an important lever for the CCP. I would say that commerce itself is an influence effort in some respects. And again, I work under the assumption of assume that it's the worst possible case and then work backwards from there, because I think this is the whole ball game when it comes to our national interest. So we better take the extreme view and then challenge it. And let's see where we end up in assessing what an economic relationship can and should look like, rather than the assumption that all trade is good and we just need to be, careful sort of at the margins. I think it's much deeper than that because of the nature of the adversary with which we're dealing.
Well, I guess that brings up another issue. There's been some talk recently. Questions have come up about, say, retirement funds and other funds investing in China. Do we need to crack down on that? Like, you know, I think it was like CalPERS recently was considering, the California pension fund was recently considering investing in China. Should that then be stopped?
Yeah, and the Trump administration itself had to fight tooth and nail, and it's sad to say, to get government pension, government investments of retirement accounts delinked from CCP-linked entities in strategically significant areas, particularly companies that serve the PLA, the People's Liberation Army. And the administration had to fight like hell to get this done, which I think speaks to how entrenched China's constituencies are within the U.S., because they're addicted to this economic relationship and think it's in their economic self-interest. The national interest be damned. And the administration also put out a list of dozens of companies with links to the Chinese military as well that are publicly traded. And the exchanges themselves, in some cases, have flip-flopped and vacillated back and forth in terms of what companies they might delist. But absolutely, when it comes to pension funds, when it comes to what hedge funds can invest in, we have to be looking at restricting investment in these entities. Why would you be underwriting your adversary's weapons, in effect? It's just suicidal. It's asinine. It makes no sense. I go back to it's short-term perceived economic self-interest versus the long-term national interest. And the long-term national interest has to be the controlling factor.
Yeah, I guess, you know, that raises, a parallel that occurs to me, again, thinking historically, as I've thought of this before. I mean, for a couple of years, I've sort of toyed with this, really ever going back to the 1990s, sort of toyed with this analogy in my head that it seems like China, you can compare sort of like the new Kaiserreich, you know, Imperial Germany rising right before World War One, that you had, the German states were united under Bismarck, and finally in 1871, and you had this growing dominant economy in Europe, and under an authoritarian militaristic culture, leaders having visions of some sort of global German empire and challenging the other European powers, that you now have, again, sort of a similar pattern of a nationalist, this sort of new Communist Party thinking, emphasizing Chinese nationalism under this totalitarian rule. And so now there's this question of what sort of country are we strengthening and arming? I guess that raises a question of, have you studied much, what is the military balance with China like vis-a-vis the United States and its allies developing now?
Yeah, first, it bears noting that the Trump administration, for all of the criticism it got on both sides, and certainly from the Biden administration as well, in terms of eschewing multilateralism, the Trump administration had an unprecedented effort to strengthen the Quad relationship, that is, with the several other critical Pacific powers that essentially counter communist China and serve as a something of like a NATO against the communist China, although it's less powerful than that. There's less resources behind it and the like. And the Biden administration, again, for attacking the Trump administration on multilateralism, has itself embraced the Quad, at least rhetorically, and there's supposed to be the first meeting between Joe Biden and his counterparts of the Quad that's ever taken place coming up shortly at the Quad members, other members being Australia, India, and Japan, which will be followed up then, of course, by a Biden administration meeting between Secretary of State Blinken and National Security Advisor Sullivan and their Chinese counterparts. Look, strengthening the Quad is essential, and those military relations are going to be critical if we are to ultimately execute a strategy to counter China in its nearer abroad and probably further abroad as well. In terms of the sort of military balance of power, you know, you can do a measurement of kind of the conventional sizes of our forces and land, air, and sea, and the sort of weaponry we have and the weaponry that China has. And that's a worthwhile exercise, and actually something that I'm going through in context of working on this book on U.S.-China policy that I'm currently undertaking. But before we get to actually the what is the balance between, you know, what's the size of the Chinese Navy and how many nuclear warheads do they have, and, you know, sort of what is their ultimate strategy and what is their readiness level. And it's worth noting that, you know, China hasn't really been engaged in a war qua war in several decades, so you never really know until you hit the battlefield. But even before we even get to any of those points, I think the critical thing to note is that on a conventional basis, the U.S. will probably continue to have the advantage in several areas, although maybe not in terms of, you know, how many ships we have on the seas versus how many ships China has on the seas. But setting that aside, there's also capability versus will, and also what the tactics are that are to be employed. So China, part of its strategy is it wants to build up asymmetric capabilities so that it can win even if it's dominated in conventional respects. That is, I don't think China would expect to win a shooting war with the U.S. necessarily as we've understood them historically. But what China would do, first thing, and there have been any number of war games that have reflected this as well, and rhetoric and intelligence out there indicating this that's been publicly cleansed, you know, that, look, the first thing that China would do in any sort of battle with the U.S. is knock out our comms and try to make us blind and unable to communicate. They would use weapons, again, unconventional weapons, and I think Michael Pillsbury has called them sort of China's magic weapons, something to that effect, so that they wouldn't have to compete in the conventional sort of assault on American forces. They would strike us in such a way that we wouldn't even be prepared to react or
Oh, what happened? We lost Ben right mid-sense. We were having an interesting discussion. Let's bring him back in the show. he just honked out. But let's bring him back in. there we go.
the Chinese Communist Party must have engaged in too much wrong think.
Yeah, that was an interesting discussion. Well, yeah. So the sort of asymmetric warfare you're discussing, using, you know, they could really punish us with like attacks on communications and so forth. They can't win strictly in a conventional sense, but they could certainly, you know, a question of will, you say, they could really deter us, say, hey, look, you just don't want to fight us. It's too, this is really too costly here. So it's just back off. I guess thinking strategically, you mentioned this Quad, something I haven't specifically studied, India, Australia, and Japan with the United States. And that brings up another interesting question of thinking about investment, trade relations, and allies and so forth. Could the United States in the past, or more importantly today, pursue policies to sort of shift economic and other ties with countries like India, or maybe say with Latin America, for trade relations and shift businesses to those markets? I mean, could, say, India replace China, or for that matter, could – going back to Nixon and the whole China debate, China opening, playing the China card against the Soviet Union, that of course involved in breaking off the official recognition of the Republic of China and Taiwan as the Chinese government and going to mainland China. Could we also somehow more instrumentalize Taiwan in any growing competition with China?
Yeah, absolutely. I'd say it's a strategic imperative to do so. And we have seen some shifting of supply chains out of China and to other countries in the region, actually, as well. China itself, of course, has pursued relations in Latin America as well, right in our backyard, which shows that it views it as a strategic a must in terms of a strategic focus to expand its sphere of influence and potentially cultivate friends in our backyard as well. So there's the strategic side of it. But look, I think the Trump administration itself, in its released a couple of decades ahead of schedule, declassified Indo-Pacific strategic framework, pointed to the fact that India was a critical interest in terms of cultivating that relationship and developing it into essentially, and it doesn't use these words, but at minimum, a counterbalance to communist China. I think it's a strategic imperative. I mean, if we can bolster India and build that as a bulwark against China, the benefits would be just manifold. And the same goes, of course, for Australia playing a role, which I would say Australia has served as sort of a canary in the coal mine because it's been subjected to Chinese influence efforts to a substantial degree, far more than we have, because so much of its trade is tied to communist China. So we ought to look to them as well for strategies and tactics for grappling with communist China. And then Japan, it speaks for itself, obviously, the criticality as a counterbalance. So, but to your broader question, absolutely, we should be looking to cultivate relationships, trade and otherwise, with every nation in that region and to try to peel them off. But of course, China is working just as doggedly to ensure that its tentacles extend everywhere, which is, of course, what the One Belt, One Road initiative is about, as well as the massive new trade deal that, or investment pact, rather, that's been agreed to in principle between the EU and China, which has been a huge challenge already for the Biden administration, which has said that focusing on a relationship with our European Union partners and allies will be essential to countering China. And before Joe Biden was even sat in office, when he was president-elect, word leaked that this investment pact between the EU and China was agreed to. And of course, I would say an investment pact like that, which will dramatically increase the financial ties between the EU and China, of course, is a huge strategic loss for America, no question about it.
Well, that brings up another interesting question. What are America's allies in places like Europe, what do they think of China? Do they have any sense of the similar sense of these dangers? Or will they, as you're indicating, sort of undercut any efforts to contain American efforts to contain China?
It really differs on a country by country basis. I think the Eastern European countries have actually shown themselves to be the strongest when it comes to seeking to counter China's efforts to expand its spheres of influence through, as I mentioned, the kind of One Belt, One Road infrastructure projects, or when it comes to Huawei building the infrastructure, telecommunications infrastructure for 5G fifth generation technology, which is supposedly represents a breakthrough in terms of speed and capability. But you saw other European countries with open arms accept Huawei building that infrastructure. The UK, thankfully, originally was on board and then dropped out. The Trump administration, one of the greatest challenges it faced probably was in convincing other countries not to allow Huawei to build its 5G infrastructure. But the number of countries that have signed on speaks to the fact that I think at a sort of high level, in some instances, these countries are either hedging their bets in terms of wanting to have Pacific and open relationships with China while also not wanting to upset the United States. And on the other hand, in some cases, may be cowed into getting along with communist China, or may think that there is sort of this inevitability, as some, you know, in the sort of Davosy globalist elite have been arguing for years, that China inevitably is to rise to be the dominant world power. So better to get on board with it now and sort of ride the gravy train than try to fight it, which means essentially that they're choosing China over the U.S. And, you know, people on both sides, the U.S. side and the China side, in both of our establishments try to say, you know, you don't have to pick between the two. It shouldn't be that sort of competition. But I do think increasingly we are going to see that there ought to be a clear choice. Do you side with the leader of the Western world, the free world, that has provided security, by the way, for all of these countries for decades and created, again, the world financial and trade architecture that has been a boon to these nations? Or do you sort of turn the other way on the U.S. and side with communist China because you think it's ultimately going to be the dominant world power and you're cowed to it? I do think increasingly, to the extent China's economy continues to grow the way it does, and of course the growth numbers that it shows, I think, are beyond dubious, but it's clear, directionally at least, China has grown substantially economically and continues to grow its military power, and then, as I mentioned, that sort of asymmetric power and beyond, that ultimately there is going to be a choice for those in the free world to answer. Do you side with the United States or do you side with communist China? And it should be very clear that you should be with the United States, and to the extent it's not, that speaks to a deeper rot that exists within the West today.
Well, you mentioned influence operations before. I noticed in one of your writings, it's interesting you say there too, with Europe, there seems to be, as Donald Rumsfeld said back at the time of the Iraq War, kind of a old Europe, new Europe distinction. You know, Rumsfeld was talking about the Eastern European countries, this new Europe. They were more pro-American, and the old Europe, the Germany and France, the more established European countries, they were more, sort of seeking maybe more mediating globalist role, not necessarily always following the United States in these various confrontations. And Britain, you say as well, followed the United States, our traditional special relationship ally, followed the United States in pulling out of this Huawei deal. But I guess that raises interesting questions about political influence. You've written in the past about states and their governors should be concerned about what's going on at their state level and political influence. And that comes back to these things like these Confucius Institutes at universities that are Chinese-run centers. What should the states or the federal government do to counter such influence operations in the United States, like at universities or in politics or in business? You think of the issue that arose with the NBA that they told one of their players to stop tweeting about in support of Hong Kong protesters, even though you can kneel for the national anthem at sports events.
Yeah, this is. One of the $10,000 questions here, how does a free society, free and open society, grapple with an adversary that is so perfectly positioned to exploit that freedom? While on the other hand, of course, there are no Jefferson Institutes over in China, and we don't have the same opportunity to sort of put forth the U.S. posture on the Chinese mainland, obviously. So to your point, yeah, I think the Trump administration took an important first step, which is you have to speak openly and honestly about the nature of the CCP and then also all of the ways in which it engages in the sort of whole of government, whole of society, comprehensive effort to expand its influence efforts everywhere across the world, using every potential means. And to your point, Secretary Pompeo himself in several speeches, he spoke towards governors as an audience, but even beyond that, spoke to the fact that, look, beyond the fact that you have Chinese money that has influenced our top research institutions and academic institutions, which includes our schools, and that's not just by way of these, what I would call sort of Trojan horse, CCP-backed and controlled Confucius Institutes, but also co-opting researchers and also using Chinese students to come over to America and pilfer strategically significant information and beyond, steal our crown jewels in effect, or at least attempt to. Beyond that, Secretary Pompeo said that states should understand that they are viewed by the CCP as potentially the weak link in our political chain in terms of exploitation. So even to the point that it's not just that there have been instances of CCP-linked individuals and entities reaching out to state legislators to say, hey, you might want to drop this resolution that's pro-Taiwan or that stands with any of the persecuted peoples in China or in the Chinese diaspora as well who have been victimized by the CCP, but even down to school boards and beyond that the CCP has tried to target them. it just speaks to the pervasiveness and the comprehensive nature of the effort, the imbalance of pervasive Chinese Communist Party influence here and no such comparable influence of the U.S. on the Chinese mainland as well. So, you know, I think the first thing is sort of do no harm. I mean, no dollars should go towards any public institution that is doing work with any of these CCP-linked individuals or entities. But more broadly, to the extent it can't be done by law, on a cultural level, I mean, we should not be having any relations with CCP-linked entities or individuals. It's pretty simple. And part of it is keeping those entities and individuals away from America. And obviously, there is a legal way that you can do that in the way of imposing travel bans and sanctions on the like. But more broadly, society has to be on board with it. And of course, the political class, even though at times there's obviously a huge chasm between where the country is and where its leaders stand, ultimately political leaders do react to political pressure from their constituents or they get thrown out of office. So there needs to be a groundswell of public opinion here and also an education effort. And I think the Trump administration did yeoman's work to try to effectuate those changes. And the unpopularity of the CCP in the wake of the coronavirus itself, I think, was very telling on this count. But there has to be a broad understanding in the country of the myriad ways in which the CCP seeks to exploit us, to undermine us for its own ends, which are at cross purposes with those of the Americans and to the detriment of our country, and that they will seek to use every aspect, every potential point of leverage ultimately to influence us. So it starts with education and a broad public outcry. And in conjunction with that, as a sort of all of the above effort, any and all legitimate legal action that can be taken to protect our institutions and our peoples against this influence operation onslaught.
Yeah, it's interesting thinking about these issues of these Confucius Institutes and not, you know, you mentioned school boards and just any and all attempts by Chinese government-linked authorities, CCP-linked authorities to influence American culture. You know, it reminds me of sort of what people talk about, like Muslim Brotherhood-linked groups or in the United States, or civilizational jihad of, you know, people trying to push those kinds of agendas in schools and universities. There's kind of a parallel there. Well, maybe closing out here, taking the offense to China, we've talked a lot about defending the United States and Western values more generally. You mentioned there are no Jefferson Institutes in China. What could the United States do to try to engage any sort of war of ideas or liberalization efforts in China in the years ahead, decades ahead, to influence that country?
Well, certainly, in the kind of immediate realm of the Chinese mainland, any and all ways that we can break through the great firewall of China, evade it, jump over it, would be more than welcomed. You know, even though it is very tough for a Chinese national to get access to a free and open internet, and even though it's even increasingly difficult using VPNs there, to the extent that we can flood the mainland with a compelling counter narrative, obviously that's going to be an essential part of any aspect of this effort. But it bears noting that we have to have the confidence in our own values, principles, our own history in order to put forth that compelling counter narrative, to be able to put up the offense that you're talking about here. And one of the things that's really disconcerting to me and concerning to me is the fact that, again, you know, while the Trump administration spoke openly and honestly about the Marxist, Leninist, Maoist nature of the CCP regime and its atrocities and its threats to the life and limb of its people, the Hong Kongers, Taiwanese, and then the American people, of course, as well, the Biden administration has said that its strategy is sort of twofold. I'll be very general here. You know, first, it's that we need to build a big front of partners and allies to engage in a competition with Communist China. And then it says, and we need to strengthen ourselves at home. Okay, that sounds good on paper. But strengthening ourselves at home and sort of putting forth our values, the entire administration thus far has sort of adhered to a 1619 project version of America, which focuses on equity instead of equality, which talks about all of America's historical ills and being a systemically racist place, and basically playing into the exact propaganda that you see when you look at any of the English language translated CCP mouthpieces that exist on a daily basis. So how are you going to win in a war of ideas if you essentially are parroting the same narratives as your worst adversary about the nature of your country, its history, its people, its values and principles and ideals. So, you know, the first thing is we need to make sure that we as a country actually believe in ourselves, our history, our ideals, principles, and institutions. And then we can go about seeking to put forth those arguments to the rest of the world and show that we do have a vastly superior model. And it's not to say that China overnight, if the CCP fell tomorrow, would ever become like the US. It's got its own distinct culture and history and the like. But it is worth saying, it's not clear to me over the long run that the CCP can ever really coexist with the Western world and, of course, with us as the dominant Western power. They view the U.S. as the number one enemy and adversary. They say it in their writings and their rhetoric. And you see this, of course, even more brightly in documents that are in the native tongue and then translated into English versus what, you know, the kind of CCP mouthpieces say when they're dealing with the West. So I think, you know, those offensive operations, there ought to be a massive information warfare effort, just like there was in the Soviet Union. But if we don't have the confidence in ourselves, our history, our ideals, values, and principles to put forth that sort of argument, of course, we've lost before that information warfare effort has already started. And then, as you know, I'll refer back to my original point, which is that overcoming the Great Firewall ought to be a huge focus of the U.S. government. And again, the Trump administration was seeking to do that. And I pray the Biden administration will continue it, because the Chinese Communist Party itself has said that the greatest threat, or a great threat to it, is the sort of war of ideas, what it would call propaganda from the West. If you use it as a strategic imperative to block and censor those ideas, a la the Great Firewall, while then propagating its own ideas to the West so that we're all speaking in the CCP-approved narratives. So we have to overcome that by building up our own intellectual fortitude and devotion to our values and principles. That's the starting point before we even get to the actual offensive measures. And of course, you know, engaging in offensive cyber warfare and rebuilding our counterintelligence and intelligence capabilities, getting back into mainland China itself. That network has largely been liquidated under the Biden administration. So we have a whole raft of challenges on the offensive side, but it starts with first having confidence in ourselves.
Well, for our listeners out there, you've been listening to Benjamin Weingarten, a fellow at the Claremont Institute and a conservative commentator who's writing a forthcoming book on China. We've been discussing China policy, past and present, and particularly under the administration of Joe Biden. Well, Benjamin Weingarten, thank you very much. And for our listeners, join us next Friday for another episode of Conservative Casual Friday.